And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. Our live shows are right here at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please remember to visit the website, podcastufo.com. Check out the latest blogs and forums. And while you're there, don't forget to like our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Sam Maranto will be joining us in a moment. We're coming at you live on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And you can catch us here every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can certainly call in during our live show, and you can call via Skype or a phone number. I'm going to give you that information a little later on. Our guest today is Don Dondary, a PhD. Don is an author of a book titled UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions. A scientist looks at the evidence. Don is a scientist who studies human vision and memory, looks at the UFO evidence, and concludes that some UFOs are extraterrestrial vehicles, some ET vehicles have ET crews, some ET crews catch and release humans, they study us. Dondary explains that psychologists know why most scientists and governments reject or ignore the UFO evidence. Much of what you read about UFOs from official sources is wrong or incomplete. The public needs reliable UFO information for intelligent discussion about the impact of extraterrestrial contact. Next week's show is going to land on Christmas evening, so we have a pre-recording show on that day. We're going to record it on Sunday, and it's with Shane Ryan in Australia. It's about one of my favorite cases, the Westall flying saucer incident. It's a schoolyard back in 1966 in Melbourne, Australia, and it should be a great show. Hey, Sam, you on there?
I'm here.
What do you think about that? I like that line that Don uses, saying the catch and release humans. That, you know, kind of like trout, I guess. Yeah.
Tag them. Snag them and tag them.
Tag them with implants, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I like the line. It hits home, I think, as far as from what it appears to be, some sort of operation of implants and tagging and tracking. This is an interesting hypothesis, and who knows?
Right. Well, you know, it always bothers me about, you know, mainstream science when, you know, we're out there, we're exploring in every which way we possibly can. You know, we're on Mars. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a second. We're on the moon. Wherever we can go, physically go and explore, that's what we're doing. Yet mainstream science will not even think of the fact that it's possible that we are being visited and explored by other beings that have that capability to do so.
Yes. And the funny thing is, it's of what we know as far as science. As far as the black world, believe me, this is very well entrenched in a number of unacknowledged special access programs being ran and operated by a number of contractors and also segments of the legitimate government. The thing is, it's so hidden, and I think the good doctor is going to be talking about some interesting aspects that he's seen. He's been around the subject for a long time, and I'm really looking forward to his input.
Yeah, it's funny. Like everyone I've told that we're having him on the show, I'll say, wow, he's great, and he's a real gentleman, real nice guy. I'm really looking forward to it. A couple of things that were coming to mind, I was looking around, poking around in the news a little bit. And there's a debate still going on. I've heard about this back and forth about melting water on Mars. And now it looks like it's pretty conclusive that it's possibly high salty water that might be melting, and because it's not evaporating right away, which water would do on Mars with the atmosphere the way it is.
Right. You know what I find interesting is, you know, from all the information we get to hear and what we know, if there's a separate secret space NASA program, maybe they're actually running there with representatives from Perrier and bottling it.
That would be expensive.
How about it?
Yeah. Hey, last week we were talking a little bit about the resources on the moon and wondering whether, you know, China's going to become territorial on there and all that. And here's a clip directly from Beijing that I picked up. Give it a listen.
China's moon rover, known as the Jade Rabbit, began surveying the moon's surface soon after separating from the Chang'e probe. The unmanned rover will be looking for valuable natural resources over the next 3 months in a challenging environment that includes a temperature range of around 277 degrees Celsius. China is only the third country in the world to successfully conduct a soft landing on the moon. The former Soviet Union was the last country to pull off a similar mission 37 years ago. Hui Fentai, ABC News, Beijing.
So, as you can see, they're really looking for resources up there.
Yeah, makes sense. But, you know, the funny thing is this was a topic of conversation well beyond the course of the scope of the show last week and the last few days. Here we are on the moon. We have this natural satellite floating around up there. And we haven't, you stop and think, well, why haven't we gone back to the moon? Why haven't we made use of this fantastic natural satellite floating around up there that we could just put all sorts of equipment on and not worry about the number of satellites we have floating around and never know when they're going to come tumbling down if it gets hit by some major solar wind or CME or whatever is floating around out there these days, debris from ISON or whoever is floating around up there, you know. And the bottom line is, what a perfect place to park some great equipment. Well, why aren't we up there? You know, I think that in itself is highly suspect that there may be more to the question, and an answer needs to be given.
You know, you think about it, it was like 76, I think, was or in the 70s, the last time that I can't remember when the last moon landing was that when we were there, but it was sometime in the 70s. That is so long ago, and the equipment that we had to get there, it really is amazing that we made it there and back.
True.
And now we have, you know, such advancements in our technology, and you're right, it's just sitting there, and it's relatively close.
Yes. Why haven't we done more, or are we? In other words, are there other programs going on, again, back to that secret space program, the secret NASA program? Is there something like that going on? It just doesn't make sense that we spent all that time and money to get there and not return and do something. My gosh, it doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense for an endless amount of reasons.
Well, I kind of like the way that, you know, the privatizing of space travel is heading, and who knows, maybe a company will take a look at that and somehow see, you know, the potential of money making going there, whether it's people that want to pay, you know, $10 million to land on the moon and walk on the moon, or $10 billion, whatever. Or the resources, you know, that's what China's looking at. They're pretty smart right now.
Well, I got my dibs on the first Starbucks.
Not bad. Well, I guess it's time for our break. We'll be coming back with Don Derry, and we're going to play a real fun tune for this break. It's a song by Moot Davis. Moot is a fan of this show. He listens to it while he's on tour. This song is about the Stephenville Lights, which is actually in Don's book that we're going to be speaking with. The Texas Lights, 2008 UFO near the Western White House, George Bush's ranch. Also, we always link to the music in our show notes. So if you want to check out the artist's site, right through our show notes. And here it is, 25 Lights, it's called.
Lights. from the sky. Landed in a field, baby, next to I-35. Well, I don't know what they want, but it might be you and I. 25 months, baby, we've been working in their mines. On the dark side of the moon, baby, slaving all the time. Ever since the day they took us in, we had to leave Earth behind. 25 lives. The most. I'll take a space hammer, baby. I'll kill whoever get close. Then we'll make a break fold and try to call coast to coast. 25 lights that came from the sky are parked in a crater, baby, right in front of you and I.
Don, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for inviting me, Martin.
Yes, thanks so much. And you're here with Sam Maranto.
Hi, Sam.
How you doing, Don?
Very well, thank you.
Don, let's talk first on how you got interested in the topic. You're a man of science, and how long have you had a fascination with UFOs and the whole phenomenon?
Well, honestly, Martin, since I was about 10 years old. That was when the first sighting was well publicized in the U.S. That was the Kenneth Arnold sighting over the mountains in Washington back in 1947. And as a 10-year-old, I was reading the magazine stories about it, found it fascinating at the time. Of course, I was hardly trained to study the phenomenon. But I basically realized that people were seeing unusual things in the sky. They weren't airplanes. They weren't at least obviously airplanes. They weren't the new jet fighters that had just shown up. And it was kind of curious as to what they were. People were speculating very early on that these might be interplanetary or extraterrestrial. There's been a long period of doubt, but for me, that doubt ended in the earlier mid-60s when the sightings became so numerous and so clear and so well reported that it was obvious there weren't visual perception mistakes or memory problems or people just trying to con other people into believing this. There was a solid block of evidence there, and as a person trained to do this, to study this kind of evidence, I realized it was something up my professional line as well. So that's when I really became interested as a professional.
Now, speaking of being a professional in what you do, do you ever get ridicule from colleagues once they find out that you're into this topic?
No, and I'll tell you why. When I first got interested in this topic, I was at, and well, I retired recently from a very good university, McGill University in Montreal. I never made a secret of my interest among my colleagues, either in my department or in the university at large. And while people were, perhaps some people, of course, were skeptical, others might have been more approving, this never was an issue in my relationship either with my own department and colleagues or the university. After I became well known in the local area for my interest in this, I was appointed to an administrative position in the university. So I don't think it really hurt me at all. And my colleagues have been appropriately and judiciously quiet about it if they haven't supported me. And if they have, they've told me so. So I've had no problems, really.
Oh, that's great.
It was. I was very lucky, too. It's not the everyday story about this, for sure.
Mm-hmm. You know the funny thing about ridicule and sarcasm, it seems to be the best form of censorship. And can you give us some insight, if, first of all, you agree with me, and some input on that?
I can, except I could go on for hours about this.
I know you can, because of your background.
Don't worry, I'm not going to. The fact is that science, we're talking about science mainly here, scientists, working scientists who get their money from the government, basically, and that's 99% of them, are very conservative creatures. They work with theories. They work with theories that other scientists propose, and they either support them by doing experiments or they attack them by doing their own experiments they think will disprove the other guy's theory. And almost all of establishment science, if you want to call it that, and remember, I participated in this science for the better part of 47 years, which was the length of my academic career. Establishment science is very theory-oriented. It's oriented towards what the other guy is doing. You're in a context in which your peers have proposed ideas that you either have to support or defend or attack, and that's the context. So if somebody comes from left field and says, forget this, there are new observations that we can't explain theoretically, there's no good theory of how UFOs work, the people who do the research are going to say, I don't see that. I literally, either I see it and I forget it, or I'm just not going to look because there's nothing there for me to study. Unless there's a theory that your peers want you to study and are willing to support you in doing it, there's no career path upwards for UFOs. I couldn't have kept on doing that except the fact that I had tenure at the university and I did other research that was unrelated directly to the UFO interest. So I kept my career going on the one hand and my UFO interest on the other, but in effect, within the university environment, never the twain shall meet.
Now, with that in mind, it seems as though people don't quite understand that even though science isn't by consensus, the political agenda always is.
Well, science has a political agenda, too, and I don't mean that in a terribly negative way. When you apply for research grants, you're applying to a committee of peers, that is, your equals, scattered across the country or maybe a couple of countries, and they evaluate what you're proposing to do. But what is the context they evaluated in? It's their own research and their own understanding. Unless I had a peer review group consisting of six people, all of whom took the UFO problem seriously, there's not a chance in hell that I would ever get a research funding opportunity for UFOs approved. So my entire research career was on other equally important things or important things, but not on the UFO problem. And that's the way it works. I'm not complaining about that because that has funded an awful lot of very good research. It's honorable. It's straightforward. If what you propose your peers think is not adequately professional, it'll get turned down. If they do, and the honest scientists, and most of them are, even if it's, say, against the theory they propose, they'll say, okay, go ahead and study it. But it has to be in the context of what other people are doing. And there are very few other people in the universities, whatever departments, that are interested in or studying UFOs.
Was this the first book that you wrote on the subject, Don?
It was. I've written a couple of articles before that in various of the UFO journals, but this was the first book on the subject. I have written other textbooks or co-authored other textbooks, and so it's not the first thing I've published by any means, and I've published well over 50 peer-reviewed research papers and close to 100 altogether when you include the technical reports. But no, this is the first UFO book.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about evidence, and a skeptic or someone that you would debate on the subject would always say, or I've heard them say most times, that all evidence is anecdotal. What would you say to that person?
That person has forgotten where science began.
Exactly.
Really,
yeah.
Back in the 19th century, in the 18th century, in the 17th century, a lot of people who were natural philosophers, as they were called in the day, studied phenomena. They went out and looked at things. They looked at the stars. They looked at animals that they hadn't seen before. They went on exploratory voyages, the most famous of which, of course, is Darwin's in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought back information about new things that they'd seen or written down or experienced or caught and captured. It was all educated anecdote. In other words, you're observing, you're recording. If you're an honest person and a good recorder, then other people will take account of what you've recorded. And that is the foundation of science. All science begins with empirical observation. The fact is, we have a whole set of new empirical observations, the good ones dating from about 1947, which are good, but for which we don't have a theoretical understanding. That doesn't mean they're not there. It just means that people whose orientation is towards getting the next research grant approved and understanding how what I'm doing fits in with what my colleague across the continent or in Europe is doing, they will not begin to study this stuff because it's too far out of line. The anecdotes are informed. They're well documented. They're not just personal anecdotes. They follow with photographs, with videos, all of which, of course, have to be authenticated themselves. But the evidence is there. And it's just that scientists in the professional context, in the ordinary academic or research institute context, don't want to touch this stuff because they don't understand it.
Right. Now, the alien abduction part of the book, you know, that you wrote about, and I really enjoyed the book, and, you know, I do want to talk about that, but was that a hard step for you to take? That's always seems to be the cutoff point where, like, the average skeptic will listen to you and actually maybe understand a lot of what you're saying about the craft and, you know, say radar tapes and all that, but when you start talking about abduction, their eyes glaze over.
That's a very good point, and I understand it. And what I generally say, if I'm introducing the topic, is that I think that, now remember, there are criminal standards for evidence, and if you're going to be convicted of a crime, the standard of evidence is beyond reasonable doubt. By the way, I'm talking not through my hat here, because I spend a fair amount of time in court. I do forensic psychology as well and testify on cases. In a criminal case, the standard of proof is beyond reasonable doubt. I think that standard has been met clearly for the existence of extraterrestrial vehicles. The standard of proof in a civil case, where you're complaining that you tripped over somebody's sidewalk and broke your knee, is the balance of probabilities. In other words, you have to be able to prove, or your attorney has to be able to prove, that the event was, as you described it, more likely than not, and the actual percentage for that turns out to be about 55%. So the balance is tipped in favor of you, but not as far as it has to be for reasonable doubt. I think the abduction phenomenon is established on the balance of probabilities. Now, I've done some research on that, and I've known the late Bud Hopkins very well, who was a leading abduction researcher. I'm a friend and colleague of David Jacobs, who is the leading remaining abduction researcher, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're respectable, principled, good reporters, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the evidence behind what they've reported is sound. I've investigated peripherally one or two abduction cases myself, but not to the point where I can state definitively that in case X, which started in, say, November 2012, I have convincing proof that this actually happened. I'm working on the cases. I'm working with people who have experienced this kind of thing, but I haven't come to the beyond reasonable doubt conclusion myself. However, the cases I put in the book, all six of them, are very sound, and I give reasons in the book why people should pay attention to them.
Yeah, I find that the context of where we what field or under what light we examine this phenomena is really important, especially when it comes to verbiage and understanding what what each word means. Say, for instance, in the court of law, we do have proof. We are allowed to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In the court of science, on the other hand, there is no proof. There's no absolutes. And I love the way you put it into the right context. Probability is the other thing that I love to hear you talk about, because probability, of course, is the very guide of life, Bishop Butler's line. And I think, you know, this is something people don't quite understand. When we're dealing with the laws of probability and well beyond, say, mathematical reasoning, this is something that we have to take into consideration, that we could put this into some sort of equation from the empirical observations. And observation is probably the most important sense or procedure. It's where all science begins and pretty much ends. So I love the way you go about talking about that. And can you give us more insight, for instance, as far as probability in the context like you were speaking?
Let me try to do that. Thanks very much for the point and the compliment. I cite in the book a leading UFO skeptic who I have a great deal of respect for. It's the late Reginald V. Jones, Dr. Jones, to be correct. He was a British scientist born in 1911, same year my father was born, by the way, and he, like my father, was involved in the Second World War. My father was involved as a Naval Reserve officer in Washington, D.C., which is where I spent a good number of the war years. Reg Jones, on the other hand, was the son of a guardsman, a Grenadier guardsman, whose the father fought during the First World War and was wounded. The son grew up in the tradition of service, discipline, and good humor, as he put it, of the Brigade of Guards. And as a young man, that is, as a young scientist in his 20s, he realized, as did Winston Churchill and Winston Churchill's scientific advisor, Professor Lindemann, that Hitler was dangerous and was basically going to start a war. So Jones, at an early age, got interested in science, physics, in national defense in Britain. And very soon after the war started, he became the director of British scientific intelligence and was particularly involved in trying to figure out what kinds of weapons the Germans were developing. He had what he called touchstones, and he was responsible for analyzing the data from many agents on the ground, agents behind enemy lines, patriotic Dutchmen and Belgians and Frenchmen who sent data back to Britain to help the Allies in their war effort. What Jones realized was that he got a mix of data. Not all of it was good, and not all of it was credible. How did he sort out the credible from the non-credible evidence? He looked for what he called were touchstones. A touchstone was some fact that came across in a broadcast from an agency that he knew to be true on the basis of previous evidence. If the agent had found one good fact and was transmitting a fact that Jones already knew was true, then Jones had a greater trust in the other facts that agent was transmitting, because they fit together in a picture that Jones knew at least was partially correct. And using that approach, Jones was able to accurately estimate the weight of the V-2 rocket warhead and its size from data that he got from agents whose initial reports included what Jones called touchstones. Now, if you go back and look at the abduction evidence, the UFO evidence, by the way, I don't even worry about. That evidence is so good, I don't want to spend any time trying to convince anyone that some UFOs are extraterrestrial, because I can cite them chapter and verse, picture after picture, and if they don't catch on after a certain amount of that, then they're just not listening. But with the abduction evidence, you've got to be more careful. And I found touchstones in the 6 cases I report in the book that are consistent and common to all the cases. And these you'll find common, I think, in almost every potentially reliable case of a catch and release. And it's this. First, the witness has a conscious recollection of a close encounter. That means seeing a UFO close to the ground within a couple of hundred yards or meters, depending on which country you're living in. And that is consciously recalled. The witness may also recall seeing humanoids behind the windows of one of these close encounter UFOs. That's touchstone number one. Any reliable case will have a witness who remembers a close encounter consciously, No fooling around with the hypnosis or anything else here. This is a conscious recall. Second point, the witness has missing time. We've all heard of missing time. It's what happens when the witness realizes a couple of hours later after the close encounter that he or she cannot recall what happened between, say, 1 a.m. in the morning and 3 a.m. in the morning when he or she finds himself driving along the road a couple of hundred miles from where the last place he can recall being was and doesn't know what happened in the meantime. Those two things are present in almost every reliable abduction case. The third thing, which is almost always present, is some kind of physical symptom or effect, either irritated eyes, reddened and burning eyes, some kind of physical mark, sometimes scoop marks or incisions that weren't there before, sometimes something as spectacular as the groin warts that Barney Hill grew after his abduction experience, some physical thing that's left over, or some physical damage to the car or smudge on the car or something like that. Touchstones 1 and 2 are, I think, universally there. Touchstone 3 is often there. Once you have these three things in hand, then you begin to worry about how the rest of the recall can be obtained. And since there's missing time, you, as an observer to a witness, don't know what happened during that time. You and the witness have to work out what happened. That's where a lot of the controversy arises, and that's where the problems start. Because sometimes the witness will have a flashback, a complete memory recall, either in the form of a conscious awakening flashback or in the form of a very realistic dream. And the realistic dream, the witness will often recall, write down, and have a evidence of after the fact. That happened to several of the cases I cite in the book, including the classic original case, the Barney and Betty Hill case. So there's a whole series of problems connected with memory recall and with memory in general. The psychology trade is very well aware of these, and they've been written about extensively. The fact that there are difficulties with memory recall does not mean that memory recall is not a tool for finding out what happened during that missing time. Mm-hmm. The problem with memory, even conscious memory, is that it's not always an accurate recapitulation of what did happen at the time. The classic example is the one that got away. The fish story always makes the bass that wasn't caught on the lake bigger by a couple of inches every time you retell the story. Now, that's well known. If you discount the fact that memory is not perfect, that it is involved with, that you're involved, your motivations are involved with it, you can overcome those difficulties and get at the heart of the story, which is consistent and which will stand the test of, say, a corroborative witness or something else. So that's the tricky part. It's the part where skeptics will pounce, understandably, if they're skeptics, because that's their business. But the whole process of memory reconstruction, either by aided recall, and there are other ways, by the way, than hypnosis for getting people to recall what they can't recall at once or is blocked effectively. Those techniques have been used, are acceptable, and fill out the picture, which includes, as you described at the beginning of the program, the catch and release process that's going on in at least many of these abduction cases.
I think within the scope, the history of perspective, what you've really captured here is the value of probability. And then putting what would be considered evidence, and then what the other things you're looking at is to diminish the value or the negative point of the fact that we do not have a perfect recall. Nobody does.
Nobody has perfect recall, and recall that's consistent across multiple observers, as is true in many of the abduction cases, gives you a picture of what's happening to them. They may not remember the exact color of some door handle or the exact tint of the light inside a UFO, but if they get the general picture right, or if they get the general picture, put it that way, and that picture is consistent with other people's pictures, then you're able to construct out of a multiple set of abduction narratives a general abduction picture. And that's been done, not just by me. David Jacobs has done it. Bud Hopkins has done it in his books. He's written, I think, 4 altogether. And that's there for people to read. The evidence has been accumulating, certainly the abduction evidence since the mid-60s, the UFO evidence since 1947, And the UFO case is beyond reasonable doubt. The abduction case is strong. And I'm absolutely committed to that point of view. I have no hesitation in expressing it.
We can take call-ins now, and that phone number is 603-967-4030. One more time, it's 603-967-4030, or you can Skype us at Podcast UFO. That's all one word. Just keep in mind that you'll have to keep trying before I can get you in, and also once I answer, you're live on the air, so be nice. Did you ever know Wilbert Smith, or do you know a lot about him and what he did? I always think of him when I think of Canada.
Very good person to think of when you think of Canada. Wilbur Smith was a government employee, an engineer, who was involved in radio transmission research and studies. And the government of Canada basically gave him permission to set up a small UFO investigating site, basically some electronic sensors and the like, near Ottawa back in the 1950s. Not much came of that, but he was in contact with the American researchers involved in the same kind of thing in the U.S. government in the 50s. And people talked to him, and he talked to people, making it clear, even though he didn't find out much himself that was independent of what we already know, that there was an ongoing and intense U.S. government interest in the subject at the time. So he stands out as a Canadian who was also quite open about it. The Canadian government gave him no hassle about it, even though he was a federal employee, and that was nice. But he didn't, and I don't mean this in any disrespectful way, he didn't contribute a hell of a lot new to the field, and neither have I, frankly. I've been a synthesizer rather than an original creator. Wilbur Smith was one of the first people who was a government employee, who was an engineer, who was in the radio communications field, and who was publicly interested in the subject and let to do his work, in fact, mildly encouraged to do his work by a permissive Canadian federal government of the 50s. A very good thing in the history of the UFO phenomenon, for sure.
Right. Now, we haven't talked much about your book. Can you give an overall synopsis of it?
Sure. The book is called UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions, A Scientist Looks at the Evidence. It was published in June by Hampton Roads Press, and it's available either as a paperback or as a Nook or Kindle. And the paperbacks you can certainly get through Amazon, and with any luck, your local bookstore will have one. The book is about 230 pages long, then adding to that indexes and various special sections. It's got three parts. The first part is about UFOs, the second part is about extraterrestrials, and the third part is about us. The UFO part covers where it began, which is the UFOs and the Cold War. The first post-war well-known UFO sighting was 1947, at the beginning of the Cold War. That lasted roughly through the 50s, the Cold War attitude towards UFOs, which was dismissive and debunking in the U.S., lasted well into the 60s and early 70s. And I discuss what happened in the late 60s and later as a chronology of doubt in which people on both sides of the question, there are UFOs, or there are extraterrestrial UFOs, or UFOs are all misperceptions or hoaxes or whatever, fought it out, basically, in the press, in public, in private, and the public, the people who read what goes on in the world, were understandably confused because there was no answer to this. Then, towards the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s and 80s, I say the argument basically ended because the evidence became so clear that anybody who really put up an objection to it was being a fool, frankly. And he or she may have been a fool in the pay of some group that wanted debunking done, but the evidence began to become incontrovertible when they started flying low, started being very big and very slow, and everybody who happened to see them was able to give a good report. That basically ended by about the mid-80s. By that time, I think anybody who'd been following the field would know the evidence was incontrovertible. Then I talk about extraterrestrials, about humanoids who had been seen and observed for many years back into the 50s. The abductions, which were first reported in 1965 in the famous Bonnie and Betty Hill case, the follow-up cases to that, and then finally a general review of what all those abduction narratives described. And then that's the section on extraterrestrials, the section on us, which in a sense is perhaps my most original contribution, first summarizes what we know. In other words, there's a sort of one chapter review of what we know about the UFO phenomenon, how it works, and what they are. Second chapter is about science and UFOs, and here's where I go into why science ignores them or ridicules them. I mentioned the fact that science is very professionally and narrowly oriented, and that there's no place for it in UFOs. There's another reason, too. It's frightening, frankly. It's upsetting. It's unsettling and upsetting to people who are either scientists or non-scientists, and many philosophers and psychologists have well understood what people can do to deprecate information that they're not comfortable with. There are many good psychological defense mechanisms against paying attention to uncomfortable facts, and I discuss all of those in this book. Finally, extraterrestrial politics. What has the government done about this? What do we know that the government has done or hasn't done? And when I say the government, I mean the U.S. government, because they've taken the most active, both suppressing and research role in the whole thing across the world, as far as I know. What's been done? What's been found? I talk about the Roswell incident, which is well known to anybody who studies the subject, a crashed UFO, which in fact did crash and was scooped up and retrieved by the U.S. government, the evidence of that having coming out over the basically 30 years since it happened in 47, and reported by many reliable people, including Stanton Friedman, Kevin Randall, and Don Schmidt, and various others as well. That's a well-established case. And then I go on to say, what should we do about it? And the answer is we should talk about it, and we should have a public discussion about what the extraterrestrial presence means to human civilization, not what we should do about it in the military sense. We should be prepared to deal with UFOs as a potential adversary. I know that. I expect the U.S. government knows that. I hope, and I have no doubt, that the U.S. government at least is doing something about that. But that's one side of the picture. The other side, in a free and democratic society, as many of our Western societies are, is that this has got to be a subject for public discussion, because it's the public and informed public discussion that leads government decisions on how to deal with this. And this is a public policy problem, and we should deal with it. That basically covers the book. Thanks for asking me. Gave me a chance to review all 10 chapters of it, starting with UFOs in the Cold War and ending with extraterrestrial politics.
Now, on the point of the Cold War, this is something that, and I don't want you to take offense to it, but unfortunately, many people in ufology have a tendency to overstate the 1947 mass sightings and almost pin down psychologically in the mindset of people who don't really know the subject matter that this is the origin of the phenomena, where in fact it goes throughout the advent of humankind. Well documented in anything and everything that is either myth, religion, any historical or cultural, history. And that's something that I have to bring it up, because it's in 1947 like four or five times. Sorry about that. Though I know in reading the book that this is where you start in the modern era, and most people just don't know. Just wondering if you'd be so kind as just to address that.
I'd be glad to. You're right. The sightings that widely known sightings began in 47. There were sightings before that, but the ones that got popular attention began in 47, and there were many sightings then. What also happened shortly after this, and the sightings, by the way, had continued more or less with a regular frequency, some times of higher frequency, some of lower frequency, but they've continued more or less to the present day, and the character of the sightings has changed slightly. You're right. It wasn't just a big splurge in 47, which got everybody excited because of the Russians or something like that. It's been continuous ever since. What is also true is that in the late 40s and early 50s, so-called contactees began to become prominent in this field. These were people who alleged to have been in contact with the Space Brothers, so to speak. There were a bunch of very active charlatans, to put it plainly, people like Dr. Daniel Fry, the doctor in quotes because he wasn't, various other people who ended up taking a lot of public space and talking about their contacts with the extraterrestrials, all of which were fraudulent, fake, and specious, and all of which were designed to get those people either publicity or money or both. And the contactees basically gave a very bad name to the whole business because they basically made the whole thing seem like a joke, something that was on the fringes of either society or religion or psychology. There was Professor, quote-unquote, George Adamski. There was Dr. Daniel Fry. There was Truman Bethurum. These people all had alien friends who they traveled with or were married to, and they all went around in spaceships and told stories about what had happened, and all of this was total bogus, completely fraudulent, completely designed to gull an innocent and gullible public, and they succeeded. So naturally, the serious part of the world would have nothing to do with UFOs because it was the whole idea was totally corrupted by the vividly fraudulent contactees who took it up at the same time. The people who study the thing seriously know that sightings continued, that reliable evidence continued to accumulate, that documentation was carried out both in the so-called Project Blue Book that the U.S. government did run and by many private investigators at the time. The history of the UFO phenomenon is not just a bunch of contactees. It's not just a mass sighting in 1947. It's been a consistent set of observations of extraterrestrial vehicles keeping Earth under surveillance over the last 50, 65 years, and probably before that, but the evidence isn't nearly as clear. So it is continuous, and to be sort of dull about this, my book is an attempt in a sort of popular way, because I haven't overwritten it in tedious academic language, to make this case in plain language, that this has been going on for a long time, and it's a very steady, very observable phenomenon. And if you haven't seen one, your friend or your friend's friend undoubtedly has, and you can probably rely on most of those accounts as being real.
Right. But again, this you're taking from 1947. I'm saying, even from my own research, I've been doing this for almost 50 years, the research is started, I mean, this is a phenomenon that's been going on since the through the advent of humankind. It's not just started in 1947.
Oh,
your
yeah,
research
I,
is
yeah.
started in 1947 as
oh,
far
I agree.
As your scope. Yeah,
no,
that's what my problem is when, like I hear Bruce, you know, Maccabee and everybody else, they overstate 1947 with the phenomena. And the fact is we somehow need to, because there's so many people that are hearing things about the phenomena that they don't understand. 1947 was the year that we gave a name to a phenomena, but it wasn't the time that it first happened. It was the time in modern history that it happened on such a volume that it caught the public media by surprise, and it stayed in the mainstream until it was basically quelled in 1952 with the Robinson panel. But basically, that's what I'm trying to say. That was it. So I hope I didn't. I obviously misstated it myself to you. The question.
No, it's not. You're absolutely right. There are plenty of reports of things that are probably extraterrestrial spaceships from before then. The difference was that after the Second World War, there was an entire technology devoted to chasing things in the sky, namely jet fighters,
correct,
and radar, and television, and good cameras that made it possible to document this stuff better than it ever had been documented before.
It was the first time in history we had sensorily designed instrumentation to replicate, duplicate, or record. This is the first time. That's the significance of 1947. And that's something, even just a statement like that, say, here, just understanding the advancement in the history of the scientific evolution of scientific instrumentation. Here is the first time we have radar, we have reliable high-speed gun camera, et cetera, not just radar on the ground, but in the air. We have planes that could achieve speeds, well in excess of 100 miles an hour, many hundreds of times faster than 100, many times faster than 100 miles an hour. So we have things that are moving very fast. We have technical advancements that are truly remarkable on all scales that we've seen throughout history. And yet this demonstrates principles well beyond the scope of Newtonian physics. So that's what I was just trying to get at. And you hit we need something. We actually need somebody in your caliber to lay something out like that. I'm probably giving you some homework to do.
I'm not.
But, I don't know.
Thanks very much. Just what
I
need.
Well, I think you're the perfect guy, Don. I'm so impressed. First of all, I know who you were before your book came out, and I was very impressed that you did this. Great job. You know.
Well, thank you very much. I much appreciate that. And there's a lot more to do. That's for sure.
Yes.
I'm impressed by the number of very conscientious, extremely intelligent and dedicated people who are putting effort, not always their day job effort either, into this, because it's still not a thing that supports many day jobs, put it that way.
That's right.
It doesn't.
It's a very good thing to do, and that includes your podcast.
Well, here's something, as you touched upon what I refer to as the pseudo-skeptics or so-called skeptics. There are so many of those bought and paid for, and much a part of the disinformation and detraction campaign that I'm sure is being funded by somebody within certain agencies or groups, whatever. And it doesn't matter where their source is. They're obviously functioning as a unit, almost like a cult to some degree. And what I find most interesting, and being a scientist and a man of understanding both science and the philosophy of science and philosophy itself, there seems to be some sort of huge discourse between the understanding of what is philosophy and what is science. And they kind of like jump to one side to another at their whim when it comes to an argument or trying to debunk or basically discredit an individual or a aspect of evidence. And I was wondering if you could address that.
I can. First of all, your point about disinformation is correct. I know that. I don't have any deep knowledge of who's disinforming us, but it's very obvious from things, and I've reported them in the book as well, that various campaigns have been waged against various people from time to time on the disinformation front, and those seem to have arisen in the 50s from the U.S. Air Force. Beyond that, there was a statement that Winston Churchill made that I quote somewhere in the book: truth is so precious that it always has to be guarded by a bodyguard of lies. Now, if the truth you're trying to suppress or prevent other people from knowing is the truth that there are extraterrestrial UFOs, you, the people who want to keep that truth hidden, lie about it. One way to lie about it is to deny it. Another way to lie about it is to provide so much spurious and specious information that nobody outside who has an intelligent wit about him or her will take the whole picture seriously, because the so-called signal-to-noise ratio is so low. If every time you look on the Internet, you see some nonsense, or you see some unverifiable UFO photo, or you see somebody talking about his contact with the aliens directly, you'll begin to basically turn off to the whole phenomenon, because you can't separate the wheat from the chaff. There's a tremendous amount of chaff. A lot of that chaff is generated as disinformation, and a lot of it is generated by people with more enthusiasm than good sense. And the combination of that, plus, I think, targeted disinformation, keeps the subject at the periphery of popular culture and out of what you call elite culture. I make a point about that. Two other very respectable political scientists have made the same point. A guy named Alexander Vent and Raymond Duval wrote a paper on that subject a couple of years ago in a political science journal. And they also wrote a chapter in a book, an excellent book by Leslie Keene, called UFOs, Generals,
you got it close.
And government officials go on the record. She published the book in 2010, and it's a very good compendium of her own bridging passages and chapters written by experts, including Vent and Duval, who talk about the fact that the elite culture just doesn't want to know about this stuff because it's threatening. It threatens the establishment of elites. It threatens the authority of people in constituted authority and power in our countries, people who are elected to represent us but who are responsible for governing us. Knowing that there's somebody up there with a very powerful machine that can essentially evade our machines and is impervious to them suggests that we're not the top dogs in the universe and that those other dogs are very close and are circling around with what motivations we have no idea. But just the idea of that is sufficiently upsetting that people want to reject it. And as I said, there are plenty of psychological mechanisms to make that rejection easy. And elite culture as a whole, that is the people who are the gatekeepers for the New York Times, Science Magazine, Nature Magazine, Scientific American, the major news, media, and networks, those people have sort of collectively closed minds about it because it's collectively disturbing. And I'll tell you an interesting fact about this that I uncovered when I was basically doing a brief promotional tour for the book in Toronto, Canada. I had an excellent publicist who got me interviews on a lot of morning TV shows and the like. And on two of those shows, one in Toronto and another one in Montreal, after the show was over, one of the hosts, in one case a TV host and the other a radio host, came up to me and said, "I saw one, and here's where it was, and what I saw," and these were both close encounters, really, within a couple of hundred yards, and they both occurred years ago. And in the case of the one man, it was out in the middle of Saskatchewan, and the other, who was, he was raised on a farm. In the other case, the woman who was in the suburban area north of Montreal. So both of these were media people, interested enough to give me an airing on TV and local radio, but both of whom had seen something like this. I expect if you scratch, that's two out of maybe 15 or 16 people I was interviewed by. So that's 1/8 or 1/10 or whatever of the media population. They were willing to talk to me about it, but they're not about to go on air and tell people they saw one. And the elite culture, the people in the media, the people who control the media don't want this widely discussed because it is upsetting and because it has a certain ludicrous factor and a certain unsettling, dangerous factor. And the two combined, just keep it out of public discourse.
Wow, that makes total sense. Again, for the listener out there, if you'd like to call in, the number is 603-967-4030. You'll be live once we answer that. And Don, was any part of writing this book in a hope that people of science will start seeing it more seriously or start looking at it? Or have you seen any type of change with anyone that's actually read this book?
Don't know. That's an excellent question. I wrote the book mainly because I had, after I retired from McGill University in 2009, I'd been 47 years in the psychology department and took a retirement. And after I retired, the Faculty of Science, which I was a part of as a member of the psych department, asked me to give four lectures in a lecture series on a general science lecture series on UFOs and abductions. Now, that was both extremely welcome and the opportunity I had to get together enough material to give four lectures. And with that start, I figured, what the heck, I'll go ahead and write a book on the subject. I had intended, after retirement, to write a book on psychology and a book on UFOs. And I was going to write the psychology book first, but having been given the lecture invitation, I turned that around and wrote the UFO book first. Of course, I hope a lot of people will read it and take to heart the idea that understanding nature is more than just dealing with somebody's theory about how things work. We don't have a theory that explains the anti-gravity drive that pushes these UFOs around. In my book, I describe work by an aeronautical engineer named Paul R. Hill, who died in 91, who worked for NASA for his entire career, basically, and who had written a book called Unconventional Flying Objects about UFOs and about how they work. He couldn't publish that book when he was working for NASA. It was published after he died because another colleague of mine, also an aeronautical engineer, discovered the manuscript and persuaded the daughter of Paul Hill to let him get it published through a publisher.
Wow.
It's there. The beginning of understanding is there, but there's no theory. And this keeps it out of science. The fear and uncertainty that the phenomenon generates keeps it out of elite culture. And where is it? It's with you and me on a podcast, on the Internet, or in other places that are willing to listen. And I hope everybody listens, frankly. I was delighted to be given an opportunity by the Faculty of Science to give talks on this. I'm equally delighted to be given an opportunity by you to talk about this, and the more the merrier. I could go across the country doing one radio interview at a time for the next year and a half. That would delight me no end.
Wow.
Wish you could.
Yeah,
I wish I could, too.
Do you know Mr. Hill was a witness to the 1952 sightings in Washington?
He certainly was. You've read the book, too. Okay, good.
Oh, yes. It's one of my collections.
Well, that's a great book.
Don, do you mind hanging out with us about another half hour?
Not at all.
Because we're right at the hour level right now, but I feel like we've just started talking.
Well, I can go on. I just wanted to remind you that the book is available on Amazon, too, if anyone really wants to get it by one-click shopping. It's there.
Mm-hmm. Is there going to be any type of follow-up book that you're starting or anything?
Not at the moment. No, I've got I haven't. I have nothing planned. And at the moment, to be quite honest, most of what I know, like 95% of what I know about UFOs, is in this book. And that's as of circa published mid-2013. It took me about a year and a half or 2 years to put together. So it pretty well reflects the state of my knowledge. I think the next great thing, and the thing that would help a lot, would be for some physicist to explain how they work. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that's going to happen tomorrow.
Well, we had a Robert Schroeder on. He had some great theories on that. It may be something you may want to check out.
That sounds like a good idea. I don't think I know who he is, but that shows my ignorance. I'm not up on everything.
How could you possibly be? There was an abduction incident that you brought up in your book, and I'm trying to remember. It was in New York City in daylight and all that.
Oh, yeah.
That is just a fascinating case.
There are two cases in and around New York. The one that's most famous was written up in great detail by Bud Hopkins, who died in 2011 and who was a very great UFO and abduction researcher. His background is worth an hour itself. He was a friend of mine. I helped Bud and a colleague of his do some work on a test, a psychology test, basically. It was designed to sort out people who were abductees or potential abductees from people who were just faking it, and that's been published, and the research is in the public domain. But that case involved a woman who actually was abducted at night, but the abduction was seen by a lot of people, most of whom are reported in Bud's book. This took place in 1996. It took place near the Brooklyn Bridge, so he called.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm. The Brooklyn Bridge abduction, and I've met the woman who was abducted. Her name in the book is Linda Cortili, and I know where she lives. I know what her life is like. We've had dinner together, and it's a good case. It's a very sound case. It's detailed in great detail in Bud's book called Witnessed. So I can only summarize to say that he was a very thorough investigator. He lives right downtown Manhattan, was essentially next door practically to where this happened, has collected a lot of evidence about it, all of which has been published in his book. I'm even in the book because I was sitting there during one of the interviews here, one of the hypnotic sessions he did with Linda Cortili. I described that in my book. He describes it in his book. So we were both there together. I was a witness to one of the abduction interviews. I describe it as I starting to fall asleep while I'd been visiting Bud, and this interview started, I guess, about mid-morning on a day after I'd spent a night at his place. Not a drinking night, I should say. I mean, we were both sober and alert. But when you start to induce hypnosis in somebody, the other people around tend to fall asleep as well. So I was beginning to doze while Bud was starting a hypnotic session with Linda. And all of a sudden, she shrieked loudly because she'd actually was re-visualizing seeing an alien come out from behind a curtain in her bedroom.
Wow.
And that shriek woke me up. So I reported that with a certain sense of humor in my book. Bud didn't bother to mention the fact that it woke me up in his book, but that's okay. At any rate, no, that book is very thorough, very well investigated, and has been the subject, by the way, of bitter debunking by various people who I don't think knew what they were talking about, just to let you know. But Bud is sorely missed. He was a friend and a very good reporter.
Speaking of debunking, Phil Klass, he was just absolutely ruthless.
He was ruthless and brutal. I agree.
Yes. And I couldn't believe the volume of cruelty as far as the Travis Walton case. And I was wondering if you could touch upon that.
Funny thing is, I never read Phil Klass about Travis Walton. I've read about the Travis Walton case, and I don't actually review it in my book, just because the book was getting too long, and I had enough good cases to start with.
Well, also, I know you're well informed about it anyway. So
no, I'm very well informed about the case, but I never actually read anything Phil Klass wrote about it, and I'm probably just as glad as I didn't. But it was a difficult case, and it was I'm convinced real, of course, as I'm sure you are, and I never saw the movie. I did follow basically everything written about the case in a substantial way, but I never read any of Phil Klass's debunking about it.
And Phil's gone and everything, yeah. But he's canonized a saint by the so-called skeptics.
Well, I always distinguish between skeptics and debunkers, and I do that in the beginning of the book. The
I always call them so-called skeptics.
Yeah.
Yes.
The reason I do that is that I've actually debated some skeptics who I respect. There are people who, in the academic world, social psychologists mostly, a business psychologist, all of whom I can talk to and say their first names without distaste, put it that way, because they think there's nothing to this, or that I'm dealing with flawed evidence, and that their research shows that these are all made-up stories and things like that. But they're presenting evidence that they've got on the basis of their theoretical predilections and some evidence that they've collected of their own. I'm confronting them as an academic with evidence of mine and with another point of view, but we're having a civilized argument, and that's one that doesn't end up with the kind of brutal debunking on either side that Phil Klass did, or for that matter, that Donald Menzel did before him. So I can live with skeptics. In fact, the guy I was citing very favorably before, Reginald Jones, was a friend of several of the original debunkers in the U.S. CIA. Robinson and one other American scientist went over to England at the end of the Second World War and talked to Jones and other scientific intelligence people, because they were trying to figure out how far the Germans had gotten on developing an atomic bomb, and that was of some interest to people. But Jones was a skeptic. I say in my book that he was a practical joker. He used practical jokes, or he used his skill as a practical joker to amuse himself while he was a college student or a student at Cambridge. He got people to do silly things by pretending to be an expert and calling them up and asking them to do it. It was really quite hilarious. He describes that in his book. Then, during the war, he figured out how he could fool the German navigators by distorting the German electronic navigation beams they were using to bomb British factories, and he succeeded in doing that.
Wow.
Then he used various kinds of deception, and the British did in general, to decoy the Germans away from the massive D-Day invasion in June 1944. He also was totally exhausted at the end of the war, and when the Swedish ghost rocket stories began coming in 1946, he didn't believe a word of it. He acted basically against his own staff, who were asked by some indignant farmer to come and take one of those darn contraptions out of his field. And he sent his staff on a wild goose chase looking for a landed UFO they never found, and he wrote about that with some humor in his own book. And then he wrote an appendix to the Condon report in which he said basically he was too skeptical to believe any of this, and he thought there were other explanations. So I wrote to him about 91 or something like that. I think I wrote a little before he died and said, "Have you changed your opinion, Dr. Jones? I enjoyed your book, The Wizard War, which is fascinating. What do you think now about the UFO thing?" He said, and I paraphrase, "There may be some, I'm still a skeptic, but it's quite possible that some evidence might come up which would convince me otherwise." And I quote that letter that he sent to me in my book. The point is, I can live with skeptics. I can happily debate skeptics. Skeptics even are likable people. But debunkers are another matter. They are basically out. They have a message, and they have an agenda. And it's an agenda, I think, driven by what you might call other interests. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, that was a skeptic true to form right there.
Okay. I can't tell you what their interests are, but I can suspect.
No, I mean, the gentleman you just spoke of was acting in a real skeptic manner, and not the so-called pseudo-skeptic or debunker.
Yes, he didn't say you're a damn fool and don't bother me. He simply said, "I don't think the evidence is there, but it could be." And that's a reasonable approach.
I think so, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the evidence is there, obviously.
Right.
But a skeptic who hasn't studied the field could very well have that conclusion, especially if he or she comes out of conventional science or conventional journalism, say, where you run into, not reliable sources every day of the week. And you have to put the picture together. And that's really what I tried to do in UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions. It's what you're trying to do online, too.
And well, objectivity is the point. And to be objective, you should also be informed. If you're not, you at least have the decency, well, I don't know enough, but from this point of view, from what I do know, this is what I feel if I'm going to be skeptical.
Right. Yeah. I don't know is a very good thing to be able
sure.
to say.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but you should qualify your understanding of a subject before you engage it. So this way you don't look like you're being one-sided or, say, for instance, have an agenda, and that could lead to many different things. And that's the problem. And that seems to, and the problem is, but today we have people who have made an industry, if not a cult, out of so-called skepticism. And I think there's parties that are very powerful parties that have agendas that are involved in these organizations. And I have reason to believe that, or should I say not believe, to conclude that. That's because of my involvement in media. And you know where I'm going.
I do, but like you, I can only go so far because I have stories from people who've talked to people. And you can't, as a good reporter, make much of a case out of something you heard from somebody who heard it from somebody else, and unless you have chapter and verse, and I don't.
Of course.
But I have good stories that would persuade me if I told them. No, I wouldn't tell them. I have good stories that persuaded me that there's exactly something to what you say, but I haven't got anything that would stand up in court, and so I can't basically talk about it or argue that I have evidence that such and such has happened. But
right.
we both have the same sense that there's an atmosphere which suggests the skepticism is more than spontaneous, put it that way, or the debunking
yes.
wasn't spontaneous. I agree.
Well, I think if we proceed, at least internally as ufologists, we proceed with that, you know, just degree of caution, I think that could save us a lot of embarrassment or nasty things down the road.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing is, I think we're fighting, as I said, against a tide which is largely driven by the unwillingness to face what are facts, but which are facts presented by such a relatively small number of people, yet that they can be dismissed as being fringe facts. And this is what science does and what the elite media do, and I explain why they do it in the chapter that's about science and UFOs, and that explains the so many good psychological defense mechanisms that you can bring up, like, for example, saying, Don Derry, he believes in UFOs. He's obviously a cultist. He's not a scientist. He's a flake. And if you just call me a flake or call me a Yahoo or call me a something like that, then you stop having to worry about what I say. So the easiest thing to do to dismiss somebody's argument is to dismiss them. And basically it's a modest form of shooting the messenger so that the message doesn't get through. And that happens all the time.
Well, it's catchphrases and idioms, and that's what I see more times than not in this their game they're playing, and it cracks me up. It's Occam razor this, it's Fermi's paradox, or they come up one-liners. They sound good, you know, to somebody who doesn't understand or know anything about science or know anything about the subject that they're even trying to address because they take it out of context.
Right. It's much easier to say that by yourself. There's not somebody else on the other side of the podium saying, oh, that's nonsense. Or I talk about Occam's razor. I talk about it in several contexts. And one of them is, right, you don't complicate explanations unnecessarily, but after you've eliminated all the other things, like this guy was hallucinating, this guy was crazy, he was drunk, he was nearsighted, his friend was also crazy, hallucinating, drunk, and nearsighted. All of those things aren't true, and the reports are consistent, and somebody else on the other side of town saw the same thing, and triangulation brings you to this large object floating about 1,000 feet over Stephenville, Texas, then you have a case. And you can't dismiss it that way. You know that as well as I do. That's right.
Sure. The other thing is, just because they may not agree with the fact or the hypotheses. Again, it's hypotheses, the extraterrestrial hypotheses. It's not a, you know, in the court of law, it could be proven above and beyond a reasonable doubt. But they want to dismiss entirely the fact that these things are here because they cannot get here from there. And that's their favorite line. You know, they cannot get here from there. Wherever there is and whoever they are, I don't know. But apparently they've got that figured out. And that's something that's absurd, because if something's there and it is definitively there, regardless of where it came from, does not dismiss the fact that it's there.
Of course. Of course. Absolutely. That argument was raised first in a paper by, a guy named Moskowitz in about 1970-something in Science magazine. I think it's one of two scientific papers ever published in Science on the UFO phenomenon. And that one said, basically, in paraphrase to what you said, they're not here because they can't get here from there. And that, of course, is nonsense. They're here, as you said. The problem is, and I said this before, we don't know how they get here. And that means that science, quote-unquote, establishment science, science subsidized by the government, will not take a look at that kind of information because it doesn't fit. Now, it also, again, there's no theory to explain it, at least no theory published in the open literature, is the way I put it. I can't go to a physics journal and find a theory that explains in detail how you build a UFO anti-gravity drive. Now, there may be people who know, but if they know, they're not telling, and the research is being done behind closed doors. A colleague of mine, a very respected colleague named Dr. Robert Wood, who's both of us, by the way, are Cornell graduates. He graduated 10 years before I did, so he's 10 years older than I am, was an aeronautical engineer, actually has a physics PhD, and spent his life, basically his professional life, working for McDonnell Douglas on all sorts of classified projects. He was given permission by McDonnell Douglas to start a UFO investigation group how many years ago. And he ran that group, as he said, without them being able to come to any firm conclusions, because it's a difficult problem, quite openly on McDonnell Douglas money for a number of years. And so he is one of the few, I think the only other scientist I know, other than Paul Hill, who I didn't know, who have actually studied the UFO phenomenon from a physical science point of view with an attempt to figure out how they work. There are a bunch of other behavioral scientists in the field, and very good ones at that. Ron Westrum and Michael Swords, who's actually a physicist, but has spent a lot of his time working on the history of the UFO phenomenon. But we don't have a clear physical understanding of how you do what UFOs do, although Paul Hill figured out what it must be that they do, but not how to do it. And this is all a fascinating, open topic, but unfortunately, I'm not the guy to do it, because my PhD is in experimental psychology, not physics. And while I have a reasonably good scientific background, I'm not about to come up with the theory to explain how UFOs work.
Well, you might be the out-of-box thinking that they need.
Well, it could be.
Yeah.
Could be.
Once again, our number here is 603-967-4030. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk, if you would, about your most interesting sighting. When I say your, I mean Canada's most interesting sighting. Or there was that one case, I think it was like in 67, where the guy was actually burned.
The Michelet case, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you don't necessarily have to talk about that, but what do you think is the most amazing Canadian experience?
Actually, you've got to get another guy in your program to answer that. There's a fellow named Chris Rutkowski.
Oh, he's been on. We've had him on.
Okay, good. Uh-huh. Well, then that's the guy to ask.
Yeah.
He's a much better documenter of Canadian cases than I am, and he would know what's current. Currently, there's a lot of activity, and I can't give you actual names of people because they're still being we're still dealing with the people, and they don't want to be publicized. But there's been a lot of recent activity in southwest Ontario, in the area west of Hamilton, Ontario. Any of you who don't happen to have a big picture of North America in your head, Hamilton, Ontario is at the very western end of Lake Ontario. Toronto is just about round the corner on the north side of the lake. Between Lake Erie then extends further west, and the area of Toronto, of Ontario, that's west of west of Hamilton and north of Lake Erie is the area we're talking about. There have been a lot of low-level sightings of not too big triangular UFOs, many close encounters, like at a couple of hundred meters low over towns and stuff. So a lot's going on currently as we talk within the last 6 months in that area. That's current. I know some details about some sightings, but most of them haven't been published or recorded yet. But I expect if you get to Chris sometime in the next couple of months, he'll be able to give you a dossier on those that's pretty complete. Mm-hmm. There's, I guess, as I said, one case in particular under investigation now, but I don't mind sound mysterious, but I can't reveal what it's about because we're still talking about it, and the people involved don't want to be publicized for understandable reasons. Mm. Anybody involved in a real close encounter has a lot at stake with the public, so as not to want to be publicly identified.
Sure.
And I've investigated a couple of close encounters, and a couple of them are described in the book, but in each case it's Bob Smith or Jim Jones, not their real names, or Professor X, not his real name. And those are people I can't talk about as individuals because it would be embarrassing to them, although I'm quite convinced their cases are real.
You know, I meant to ask you, you just said you researched a couple of cases. Is that something you actually do part-time?
Not much, no. I'm not what you'd call a first-line UFO investigator. I haven't had the time to do that. I should add, I'm not retired in the sense that I sit around the house, as somebody said, following my wife around as she works. I actually have a day job. I am a business consultant as well, and I do that. My field in psychology is not personality or therapy. I don't do that. I'm not licensed to do it. I give advice to businesses, to engineering companies, to lawyers on the perceptual, motivational, and cognitive aspects of plants they're building or factories they're setting up or legal cases they have to deal with, and I keep fairly busy at that. So I don't really have time to do that, and I think the people who do it are much to be admired, but I have spent relatively little of my time as a field investigator, much of it back in the 60s when I was working with a group called UFO Quebec. This is obviously Quebec being a largely French-speaking province. UFO Quebec was a French-language research group. We met regularly. We pursued a couple of cases, and one of them at least is one I mentioned in the introduction to the book that took place at a lake in northern Quebec in 1978, that was. And that was a close encounter over a lake seen by two people who took photographs, and the follow-up for that was what I've described. That was that's the one case I've been most directly involved in as a observer and recorder, and that was with the help of another fellow, also unnamed in the book, who we'll call Bill Wilson, who was another member of UFO Quebec.
Now, was that real large craft that went around the lake?
It was. It was pretty big. It was about 1,000 feet from the people who were observing it. I think it was probably, it was a classic flying saucer shape. There's a picture, the first picture in the book is a picture that was borrowed from that case, or it was actually made from the negative of that case, which was collected. And I'd forgotten if we say how big it was. I know we say how far away it was. I'd say it was probably in the, if I remember rightly, 30 to 50 feet in diameter. That's the best estimate. And very intensely luminous, classic flying saucer shape, and seen by two witnesses, and clearly nothing. And the photograph was carefully authenticated. And so it was nothing else but a UFO. And I used that case in the introduction to the book to say something like, and here I introduce Occam's razor for the first time. Occam's razor is a principle that suggests that you don't complicate explanations unnecessarily. It certainly complicates things to describe this as an extraterrestrial UFO. So what would the razor-equipped skeptic say? And I go on to say, the razor-equipped skeptic would say that this guy faked the photograph and that the story was a lie. And then I go through the evidence that we collected that the photograph was not faked. Then I talk about the fact that it could still not be a UFO, an extraterrestrial UFO. It might have been an American or Canadian secret weapon being tested in the middle of the night in March over Lake Baskatong for no particular reason. And then I go on to say that the rest of this book is an extended argument that the fact that this was an extraterrestrial UFO is a better explanation for this and all the other stuff in the book than that this was a American or Canadian secret weapon being tested over Lake Baskatong in the middle of the night on March 13th, 1978. And so that's the kind of reasoning I use. I apply the skeptic's razor, and I say the remaining case, the remaining cause, once you leave out all the others, is either it's a human secret weapon or it's an extraterrestrial vehicle. And by the time you get to the end of the book, you should be completely convinced that it and almost everything else reported in the book is or was an extraterrestrial vehicle.
Uh-huh. One of the questions that seems to come up a lot, or something that I always like to hear different opinions on. I personally don't think that it's going to happen through the government, but what do you think about disclosure?
Very interesting. Obviously, a lot of people are pushing for it. That's fine. If the government were to turn on tomorrow and tell us what they know, we'd all be flabbergasted, and I would be quite surprised. It's hard for me to know what's in the mind of people who do know, and I know as well as you do that there are certainly people who have as strong or stronger a case to make about UFOs than I've made in this book or any of my colleagues and friends have made in theirs. It's still, how shall I put it? It's from the point of view of the people who control the research and development efforts of the U.S. government. Let's just stick to that because I don't think Canada is a major player in this. I don't think any of the European nations are. Russia may be, but I don't know that, and I have no way of knowing that. The U.S., I do know, is because of the Roswell incident, because of the obvious cover-ups, the obvious, the incredible quality of the surveillance equipment and apparatus that the U.S. government deploys to counter ballistic missiles and incoming hostile aircraft and the rest. These must have picked up what observers on the ground have seen over the last 65 or 70 years. So I know the U.S. government knows about this. I have the same kind of story you have that nobody can cite without appearing to be a flake, that so-and-so knows this and so-and-so knows that, but they cannot be. I can't cite these stories because they don't have any. There's no lead to them. There's no hook. There's no fact behind them other than what well-informed people have told me. So the U.S. government does know. Will the U.S. government tell us what it knows? I hope that the fact that I've written a book like this that makes the case pretty clear will persuade people that they should stop hiding behind secrecy. First of all, as I'm sure you do know, and as I report quite clearly in several incidents, the U.S. government has tried to, in its original process of scooping up information, intimidate or prevent people from talking about what they did know or did see, which the government didn't think they should have seen or known. But that's sort of not so important anymore because so many people have seen UFOs and so many people who are experts, like pilots, radar operators, traffic controllers, and the like, know what they've seen, that keeping this secret at that point can't be done anymore. The word is out. It's in the public domain. We either know about UFOs from what we've heard from air traffic controllers or pilots, or what we read or hear on your podcast or somebody else's website or whatever, that we know the facts are there. The only way to keep the facts from percolating through the public consciousness and becoming part of our political debate, which everything else is, like Affordable Care Act or immigration reform, that's UFOs are still not part of the public political discourse, and that's because they're still treated as something peripheral by the elite media and by most of the public. Why? Because the signal-to-noise ratio is so low, and second, because the government knows a heck of a lot more than it's telling us and won't tell us. Why not? Because I think they're still afraid of the consequences. What happens to the public debate when it is an open and widely understood debate? What do we do about the fact that there are extraterrestrial craft surveilling, if you like, I'm not even sure that's a good verb, the Earth, and certainly our part of it, and Canada's part of it, for that matter, and Europe's part of it. Wherever there are observers, there have been UFOs seen reliably. So we're under surveillance. We're under surveillance in the same way that we have a curiosity about and an interest in other four-footed species on this planet.
Right.
We fly over bears. We tranquilize them. We haul them away in a net on the bottom of a helicopter. We stick needles into them. We look at their basal metabolism. We stick a telemetry chip in their neck. We drop them back where they were. They get up. They scratch their head. They wonder what the devil happened. And they go about their way. We don't interview them afterwards. But they've had 45 minutes or an hour and a half of missing time as well. And we don't know what they make of it. And they're not very verbal, as far as we know. So they're probably not spinning stories about it. But there's a gap there, the same as there is in our abductee's life. And it's been filled in somewhat the same way. So somebody's looking at us. Somebody's curious about us. Somebody who's technologically better than we are. I don't mean nicer. I have no idea whether they are or not. And I rather hope they are, but I can't prove that. But they're there, and they're watching. And this is upsetting. And the people who are responsible for our health, safety, and well-being would rather we not think carefully about it because they don't know what to do about it. I think that's the problem.
That's right. Well, you know, it's been really wonderful having you on. Thanks so much for joining us for this show.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for inviting me again. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Yes,
see you, Dan. Thank you so much.
We'll have to have you back again.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to our show, and please remember to check out our website, podcastufo.com, for the latest blogs and forums. We will be back next week. Thanks again, and remember, keep your eyes to the sky.